The Vampire Lestat, The Oedipiphany. In episode 2, Toledo, Gabriella stars in a Freudian trip down memory lane, pairing flashbacks to Lestat's youth with a sleazy mother-son date in Ohio. Written and read by Gavia Baker-Whitelaw. "It's different for vampires," says Lestat in the closing moments of episode 2, an excuse he tosses out as a last resort after struggling at length to defend his incestuous relationship with his mother. The preceding 45 minutes, however, do not exactly support his claim. Lestat and Gabriella's dynamic is obviously fucked up when they're drinking each other's blood and prowling strip clubs together in 2025, but they weren't a picture of healthy family behaviour back in their human days either, as we discover when Lestat's voiceover turns back the clock to 18th century Auvergne. Setting the tone with some very direct allusions to Freud, we're invited to examine what kind of parenting creates an individual like Lestat. Most likely due to budget and time constraints, this episode compresses Lestat's youth into a handful of brief scenes in his ancestral home, in a sequence that will probably be received very differently by viewers depending on whether they've read The Vampire Lestat. Introducing Lestat as the youngest son of an ancient but unimpressive aristocratic family, episode 2 depicts his childhood as a time of isolation. His father and brothers are brutes, while his mother spends as much time as possible with her head in a book, poisonously frustrated by the restrictions that society has forced upon her. Sensitive, stuttering young Lestat is the one exception to her disgust, sharing her outsider status in a household of bullies. One notable element from the book that didn't fully make it to the screen is the fact that while Gabriella values education very deeply, she doesn't make any attempt to educate Lestat herself. She outsources this task to a local monastery, a revelatory chapter of his life in the novel, but glossed over quickly here. And when her husband forces Lestat to return home, only partially literate, she leaves him to fend for himself. So while Lestat is her favourite child, she isn't particularly interested in raising him. She simply doesn't want to be a mother. When Lestat finally gives Gabriella the dark gift, saving her from terminal illness in 1794, vampirism offers Gabriella a freedom she never had in her mortal life. No longer trapped by the drudgery of an arranged marriage and years of unwanted pregnancies, she embarks on a life of adventure, with a strong suggestion that she prefers to go it alone. In 2025, Lestat is still begging for scraps of her attention, which she doles out in the form of sex and mind games, rather than straightforward affection or support. In these flashbacks to Lestat's youth, his abusive father and brothers are simple caricatures, a detail we can potentially attribute to Lestat's perspective as a narrator. If one views this period as the first act of a musical biopic, Lestat's family slot into the kind of archetypes we see parodied in the movie Walk Hard. Essential viewing, in my opinion. Casting Lestat as an underdog protagonist who will one day become a superstar, we see his father punishing him for loving the arts and failing to conform to an expected image of masculinity. When Lestat drags up these scenes from distant memory, he characterizes his male relatives as cartoonishly repulsive, while his mother is beautiful but distant. Everyone also happens to be wearing a truly abysmal wig, regrettably not an intentional creative choice. We must also recall that even the French and Italian accents are coming from Lestat's narration, where his long-dead relatives speak in pretty basic explanatory language compared to the rapid-fire wordplay of the contemporary vampire characters. The turning point of Lestat's adulthood comes when the local townspeople beg his father for protection from a pack of wolves. Lestat is the only one who answers the call, encouraged by Gabriella to ride into the forest with his dog and his gun. "She meant to kill me with the challenge," he tells us. "Better a quick end than watch me surrender another decade." But Lestat survives, killing 8 wolves and returning with claw marks gouged across his chest, creating the scars that Louis failed to mention in the earlier seasons. Previously played by 2 younger actors during the earlier flashbacks, Lestat is now Sam Reed again, meaning that he's close to the age he was when he was turned. And once he proves himself capable of deadly violence, Gabriella's interest takes on a very obvious sexual undertone, suggesting that their present-day dynamic isn't purely due to vampirism. Tending his wounds in the aftermath of his wolf hunt, she delivers a deeply bizarre monologue, recounting a sexual fantasy about getting gangbanged by all the men of the village. Shot from the shoulders up, the scene keeps her hand placement ambiguous, but she seems to be touching something higher than the wound on his thigh. "No thought of your father or your brothers," she croons, as a nearby housemaid looks away in discomfort. "In that moment, I belong to no one." "Except for me?" Lestat asks, with childish hope in his eyes. Gabriella does not reply, smiling serenely as we process the 1-2 punch of her diabolical parenting and hypnotically peculiar Italian accent. My personal highlight has got to be her sing-song pronunciation of the phrase, "bathe in the mountain stream naked," a flavour of line delivery you can only get from a heavy-hitting character actor like Jennifer Ely. Highly recommend her 2019 horror movie St. Maud, by the way. We then skip rapidly over the next few years of Lestat's life, seeing only a few tiny glimpses of Lestat's lover Nicky and the point where he turns Gabriella into a vampire, thus securing a new connection as Maker and Fledgling. Already we can sense the unsolvable conflict at the heart of their bond. Lestat will spend eternity demanding more than Gabriella is willing to give, while in her own words, Gabriella wants to belong to no one. Unlike Lestat's other favourite fledgling, Louis, Gabriella displays no squeamishness about drinking human blood and no moral qualms about murder. In fact, her first act as a vampire is to travel back to the family home and slaughter her husband and sons with Lestat as her accomplice. The next morning, her grandchildren scream as they find their parents and grandfather hanging disemboweled from the walls, a scene that Lestat recalls while singing an anguished piano arrangement of Baudelaire's poem, The Fountain of Blood. He remembers lying wide awake in the family crypt as the children weep outside, while his mother sleeps peacefully by his shoulder, untroubled by guilt. These flashback scenes are interspersed throughout the episode. In the present day, Gabriella joins Lestat's tour under the name Sophia, revealing her vampirism but disguising their true relationship from the rest of his entourage. That's undoubtedly a smart move because the others already have enough on their plate without dealing with vampire incest drama as well. For the past 18 months, Lestat's band have been working under the assumption that he's an eccentric European with a high-concept stage persona. Now they know the truth. Travelling toward their next stop in Toledo, Ohio, they freak out over Lestat's backstory in Daniel Molloy's book. Are all your songs about this guy, Lewis? And more urgently, about the realisation that they've hitched their wagon to a serial killer. Lestat assures them that he gets most of his blood from voluntary donors, all highly ethical. But unsurprisingly, this doesn't put much of a dent in their panic. Guitarist Alex winds up quitting the band, although Lestat informs him via telepathy that he's welcome to return once he's cooled down, labelling him the best pure musician we have other than me. For all that Lestat tries to paint himself as a hedonistic rock god, he doesn't seem to be having much fun on tour. He's surrounded himself with people who make demands on his time, lawyer Christine, ask invasive questions, documentarian Daniel, or are too human to be treated as equals, the band. Gabriella is his only option for a true companion, continuing a cycle where she swoops in to pick up the pieces after his latest breakdown. At one point he notes that he's only seen her twice in the past century, once after Louis attempted to kill him in 1940, and once after their reunion in the season 2 finale. When things get really rough, Lestat calls out for Mommy, craving the comfort of his most long-standing, toxic relationship, because the only other choice is loneliness. For now, Maker and Fledgling go on a cute little date in Toledo, which Lestat declares via voiceover is America's second most depressing city. Wearing a fur coat that calls back to his iconic wolfskin cloak, he already seems to regret hooking up with Gabriella after last week's kiss. "I know, we really shouldn't," she agrees, as if she's coyly refusing a second helping of dessert. Lestat suggests that they make a pact to keep things platonic, but it's hard to imagine this lasting for long. They can't go 5 minutes without flirting, and anyway, Gabriella isn't interested in behaving herself. Which is how they end up in a strip club that same night, stalking a group of drunk businessmen while Gabriella strolls around catching ping pong balls from a stripper's vagina. In his voiceover, Lestat tries to impress upon us how uniquely charismatic she is and how good it feels to exist in her presence. Ironically, it's not unlike how Louis and Armand used to talk about him. This fun family outing gets interrupted by a call from Christine, telling Lestat to show up for a meeting with someone named Thomas Pitt, the owner of the hotel he trashed in episode 1. Apparently the guy wants an exclusive fan experience to make up for the damages. "Do I have to fuck him?" asks Lestat with a sneer. "Yes," replies Christine, a joke that isn't entirely a joke. From the opening of season 1, sex work and transactional relationships have been a central theme for this show. Louis's career as a pimp, Armand's backstory as a trafficking victim, Daniel referring to himself as Louis's whore, Blood Farms and characters like Dee Farma, whose role this season is played for laughs, but is honestly very dark. Last week saw Dee reassure herself that she's in charge of her work-life balance, in between fucking her boss and witnessing a massacre where she could easily have died as well. This week, Dee's other boss, Christine, calls her a drug mule and a cocaine whore bucket in front of her co-workers, while reminding everyone that they're contracted to keep their mouths shut about any murders they may or may not have witnessed. Lestat also happens to be sleeping with Christine, as we learn during his meeting with Thomas Pitt, aka Louis, who is also sleeping with his lawyer, Lemuel, played by the musician Moses Sumney. No one here has an uncomplicated sex life or a healthy relationship to their job, a fact which puts a dampener on Lestat's framing of his elevator threesome last week. Handwaving any potential questions about sexual trauma, he seems aggressively keen to assure us that A, he's a fun, horny, casual guy with no hang-ups whatsoever, and B, sex isn't as important as blood drinking, an act of transcendent vampiric intimacy that's conveniently fine to share with your mom. Sam Reed and Jacob Anderson have both spoken about how Louis will seem different this season, appearing more confident and poised when depicted from Lestat's perspective. Lestat gives him back some of his essence, Anderson told Den of Geek, some of the more playful and also fiercer side of Louis that we haven't really seen. This comes out in full effect during the Thomas Pitt scene, where both characters are very much in their divorce era. Communicating via lawyers across a conference room table, Louis appears calm and therapized opposite Lestat in full tantrum mode, reacting with hypocritical outrage at the idea of Louis hooking up with someone else. Twisting the knife even further, business mogul Louis has bought up 45% of the Vampire Lestat's merchandising rights. Honestly, these two crack me the fuck up. From Lestat's perspective, this is an interaction between a desperate, jealous lover, Lestat, and an impervious wall of restraint, Louis. An interpretation coloured by our newfound knowledge of Lestat's obsession with an emotionally withholding parent. But in actuality, Louis is the one who arranged this meeting and invited Lestat's band to promote his hotel, Dracula's Daughter, in the first place. In the grand tradition of ugly divorces, he's hell-bent on maintaining legal and financial ties to his ex, in this case in a distinctly underhanded fashion, because he's been operating under an assumed name as Thomas Pitt. Louis and Lestat will never be fully broken up because they're soulmates, although we shouldn't fall into the trap of thinking they're actually good for each other. Their honeymoon phase was tangled up in abusive power dynamics and clashing forms of emotional instability, and at this point in their story, Louis probably is right to interpret Lestat's music career as a self-destructive cry for help. Attending Lestat's concert in Toledo, Louis stays calm and collected in the balcony as Lestat pauses time to fly up in the middle of a song, performing straight for Louis as he hands over his heavily annotated copy of Interview with the Vampire. It's probably my favourite musical moment of the first two episodes, illustrating the often contradictory qualities of the original music written for the show, sincere yet theatrical, combining intense emotion with, in this case, comically simplistic lyrics. Meanwhile, Daniel tells his camera operator to pan between Gabriella and Louis in the audience, predicting that both will be important figures in the final cut of his documentary. I haven't spoken much about Daniel thus far, but his big moment comes in this episode's final scene, when he meets with Louis in a restaurant. Helpfully, Lestat's voiceover reminds us that this entire conversation is fabricated because our narrator wasn't actually there in person. While Daniel was clearly lying when he said he didn't have transformational trauma, he does seem to enjoy being a vampire, embracing the rock and roll lifestyle, and generally acting like a total asshole now he's escaped the looming progression of his Parkinson's symptoms. His leather jacket screams midlife crisis, but he's really more of an adolescent, an abandoned fledgling trying to prove that he can go it alone. After betraying Louis to publish Interview, He wants to patch things up, in part because Louis represents one of his few potential allies and sources of vampiric advice. Can Louis explain why Daniel keeps having weird visions where everyone else vanishes and the only person he can feel is Armand? Apparently not, suggesting that this phenomenon is unique to their meeker-fledgling bond. Louis can't offer any further insight, but in exchange he shares a curious anecdote of his own. Recently he came across a young woman who looked almost exactly like Claudia, and followed her to her job in a diner. Not literally a ghost, but certainly a haunting experience. Grief is weighing on him once again, and with Lestat being kept at arm's length and Armand in the rearview mirror, Daniel is the only person left to tell. Telepathic visions aren't the only thing Daniel shares with his maker, it turns out, because he soon segues the conversation into a classic Armand-style boomerang of betrayal. Mere minutes after apologising to Louis for disrupting his reunion with Lestat and profiting from their shared trauma, Daniel reveals that this meeting is actually a pretext for the Talamasca to get in touch. Real Rashid and Raglan Jones then slink out of the shadows so Justin Kirk, Raglan, can dazzle us once again with his indecipherable accent, and interrupt Louis's healing journey with a transparently manipulative request to assassinate Bruce, the vampire who raped Claudia in season 1. Along the way, Louis mentions that he's already killed the Talamasca agent David Talbot off-screen, an ignominious demise for a prominent character in the Vampire Chronicles novels. No great loss, says Raglan cheerfully. None of us liked him much. As ever, it's tricky to recap this show in anything approaching chronological order. Louis's Talamasca meeting closes the episode, but it also runs parallel to the flashback showing the gory demise of Lestat's human family. In the present day, Lestat sings Baudelaire with a 1,000-yard stare, surrounded by corpses in an Italian restaurant, a local recommendation from a man Gabriella killed at the strip club, purely for her own entertainment, rather than any need for blood. Here we see the contrast between Gabriella as a truly remorseless hedonist, versus Lestat, who struggles with impulse control and bears more obvious after-effects of trauma. For instance, he's currently meant to be steering clear of outright murder, relying on blood banks and transfusions so the Vampire Lestat's tour doesn't leave a trail of mysterious homicides in its wake. But within a few hours of reuniting with Gabriella, he's breaking his diet and going on a recreational killing spree. We couldn't help ourselves, he explains during an earlier section of his voiceover, as Gabriella takes an orgiastic drink from his throat. We rode the edges of our pact. Clinging to denial by the skin of his teeth, he tries to defend their behaviour, first by pointing out that every family includes some inbreeding somewhere down the line, and then by suggesting that social norms were different in the 18th century. In the end, he has to throw in the towel and claim that incest doesn't count if you're a vampire. But judging by everything we've seen thus far, Lestat clearly knows that it does.